Okay, good evening, everybody. Shalom Aleichem, and thank you so much for joining us. It is a it's a pleasure to welcome you all here, and looking forward to hopefully five meaningful sessions on the topic of Bishul B'Shabbos. I would like to thank Lisa and Russ Breen, who have sponsored tonight's shiur, Le'iloi Nishmas Enya Bas Reuven, whose yard site is tonight. We pray that her neshama shehev and aliyah. So as you can tell, decided to go PowerPoint style over here. For those who have participated in the past in some of the other PowerPoint shiurim, I want to sort of apologize from the outset that this is going to be in some ways a little less exciting because for this particular topic, at least, you know, I'm preparing them as I go along, so one shiur at a time. But really the focus over here, of course, is on substance and information. And of course, it's a nice forum to be able to look at sources and to review them together, and I certainly hope some of the pictures that accompany these discussions will at the very least make the discussion a little more meaningful. But really, this is no frills, this is no shtick. This is really, I hope, what will be a very meaningful endeavor, one which in theory could take many more than 5 weeks. But as I'm going to explain in a moment, my goal is really to try to make this conversation as comprehensive as it needs to be, but really with an eye towards being very practical and as specific as possible, so we can talk about the many situations that we will encounter when it comes to the question of Bishul B'Shabbos. Now, of course, when it comes to Hilchos Shabbos in general, we know that there are so many resources that are available, really spanning the centuries, you know, going all the way back to the Mishnah, up until and including this very day, many, many volumes have been written exploring the incredible depth and vast ocean. And I say that, which of course we can say applies to every section of Torah. When it comes to Hilchos Shabbos in particular, it is such a massive endeavor, one that has been researched and discussed. And there are so many different points of focus and greater eon and analysis that we can explore. I wanted to begin, however, tonight's discussion by sharing with you a couple of excerpts from the Hakdama, the introduction of the Mishnah Brura, and specifically the third volume of the Mishnah Brura, which deals with Hilchos Shabbos. The Mishnah Brura writes, "Be'eza inyan nuchal lavo lazu amadregos yishmor Shabbos b'chol pratav." What strategy, he says, can we employ in order to be able to observe Shabbos properly? The greatest advice I can give is that one should be focused and diligent and make every effort to study the laws of Shabbos, and to review them constantly, in order that a person can know that which is forbidden and that which is permissible. Because if not, then even if a person studies certain areas of Torah which inspire one to observe Shabbos in the most optimal fashion, so for example, if a person studies a Musar Sefer, which talks about how great Shabbos is and what an incredible opportunity is for a person to reach new heights and levels in one's own spirituality, that's very nice. However, if a person doesn't know at the end of the day how to properly observe Shabbos, the details of Shabbos, so lo yo'il. And he quotes a Medrash. The Medrash of Mishlei teaches on the Pasuk, Ladas Chachma u'Musar, to know, to understand Chachma, wisdom, and Musar. If a person has wisdom, has the knowledge, has the information, so then he could study Musar. If a person doesn't understand, that doesn't have access to that information, the knowledge by which he can apply all the inspiration that he achieves when he studies Musar, so then the Musar can only take him so far. If a person studies Musar and says, that's it, I'm going to be the greatest Shomer Shabbos I can be, but doesn't know, as he or she is just experiencing the normal, the everyday experience of Shabbos, he doesn't know what is us and what is Mutar, so then what does that accomplish? Here as well, He says, v'chein b'melachos dash, v'lisho, melabin. We could say this is true when it comes to many melachos, and he mentions several in particular. And then he says, certainly when it comes to bishul, v'shihi avahatmana, which we'll define probably not even so much tonight, but in general over the next 5 weeks, who hilchos rabasim yo, this is a very complex and a very important, but really complicated area of halacha. Baharbe chiluki dinim hanogei l'maisa, with many, many fine and particular nuances which affect our practice, halacha l'maisa. V'kvai heyer agon ba'al urim v'tumim b'sifro yaris devash, ki efsha klaba metziya shinatzam isr shabbos en lo yomar kol dinim aburim heitev. Then he quotes the Yaris Devash, who says, it's impossible for a person to avoid, obviously inadvertently, but to avoid being mechal Shabbos on a regular basis, unless a person studies the dinim thoroughly and properly. Now, when it comes to Hilcha Shabbos in a modern kitchen, which includes some of these appliances, but of course many more, the truth of the matter is we're only talking over here about Bishul Shabbos. Things have really accelerated over the past 10 years, 5 years even more so, and maybe even the last year or two. So it's not only now when it comes to discussing, the status of a warming drawer and certain, these new fancy stovetops that don't even use fire, but whether we're talking about refrigerators or alarm systems or doorbells or thermostats, the truth of the matter is, even if you don't officially have a smart home, there are so many things that are slowly being introduced into our normal everyday lives that make the proper or halachic observance of Shabbos a little more complicated. These are challenges that are, by and large, not insurmountable, but we need to be mindful of them and constantly not just review the laws, but make sure that we know how to apply them. Of course, we are all very tempted, I imagine, right now, to start breaking down each and every one of these pictures over here and say, okay, so what's the deal with a coffee maker on Shabbos? What's the status of a warming drawer? When may I not put food in a warming drawer? But rather than delve right into this, we're going to resist the temptation and follow the advice of the Mishnah Berurah. And I return right now to his Adam, and this is the last excerpt from the Mishnah Berurah that I'll share with you. He says, "Achas me'asibos hashiyimna la'olam yadiba hilchos Shabbos." One of the reasons why, unfortunately, often people don't really have a proper grasp on the laws of Shabbos, hupnei shalocha chamurim yod, v'yefshal havina heitiv mitoch shochan aruch im lo sheyedim etchila mekori adim begemara poskim, because it is difficult to really understand often. Not always, but often it's difficult to understand what it is that the Shulchan Aruch is teaching if we don't understand, at least on some basic level conceptually, where these ideas are coming from and understand the Makaris in the Gemara. But the problem is, he says, and he says this Bizmanenu, the Mishnah Berurah was published about 100 years ago, we're very busy and it's very difficult for most people to find the time to actually go ahead and to study Hilchos Shabbos going back to the earliest sources. So he says, that's why I have taken upon myself to compose the volume of the Mishnah Berurah with the hopes that I can go ahead and present not just the bottom line, not just the halacha, but some of the background, and to point out when there are different opinions how we paskin. What's ironic about this is that over the last 100 years there have been so many volumes that have been published on the Mishnah Berurah, on Hilchos Shabbos and the Mishnah Berurah. So it's not as if the Mishnah Berurah has given us all that we need, and we could not conceivably imagine the need for a more comprehensive discussion, particularly again as it applies to some of the modern situations and scenarios that we are going to encounter. Now, I don't have to make a case for what we're discussing tonight because you're all here, so I guess that you thought this topic was important and relevant. I do want to mention that it is important to study Hilchos Bishul in particular, even if one has a very simple routine at home, because the fact of the matter is there are times where we find ourselves in other people's homes, family and friends. And while I would never recommend, generally speaking, going to somebody else's kitchen and seeing what they're doing and how they're doing, but it is always important, whether we're in our home or someone else's home, to just be fluent and knowledgeable and to know what is, what it is not allowed on Shabbos, what is a problem l'chachila, but okay b'di'evid, and what's not even okay b'di'evid. It's just important to be knowledgeable and as familiar as we can with the laws of Bishul, even if, and this is sometimes the case where people have very, very simple routines at home and don't really even prepare or cook all that much. Even though I am not going to, at least I don't think I'm going to be stopping at any point saying, if you have any questions, feel free to interrupt at any point. It's better that whatever we share tonight be clear rather than be misunderstood. And just as far as just a general outline of what we're going to do tonight, going to just try to introduce, first and foremost, just talk about the concept of malach in general. And when we present the laws of Bishul, we're going to focus first and foremost on the Dinei Doraisa to understand some of the most serious issues that we may encounter when we talk about Bishul B'Shabbos. Although a major section of the practical laws of Hilchos Shabbos, particularly when it comes to reheating food, for example, which is something that many of us like to do and do, so then we enter into a realm of Isuri D'Rabbanan, which apply to Bishul B'Shabbos, which is a very different discussion. So we're really going to try to be very careful and deliberate and take, you know, a patient approach over here when approaching this issue. So when we talk about cooking on Shabbos, now here you have pictures of lots of cold foods. I don't know if there's anything that appeals to anybody over there, but if Google is correct, so each of these foods are cold. They are prepared cold, served cold. And you may ask, you may wonder, if the laws of Shabbos are really so difficult and so complicated, you know, maybe it would just be easier to avoid all these Shabbos altogether and just have cold cuts. Now, some of us do have cold cuts on Shabbos, and you have salads, and there's nothing wrong with that. But why don't we just avoid this? If, in fact, it's true, as the Aris Devash said, that it's impossible to avoid it inadvertently anyway, violating Shabbos, if a person is not, you don't have to be an expert, you don't have to be a posek, but a person is not very well-versed and fluent in the laws of Shabbos, then let's just avoid this altogether. So I want to share with you a very interesting comment of the Baal HaMor, who writes, that there is a special takana, there's a special institution for the rabbis, that we should actually enjoy Shabbos by eating chamin, which is probably, it's not necessarily translated literally as, but that's certainly what we do when we eat shalant on Shabbos. The same could be said about soup, chicken soup Friday night, but, you know, when we eat hot food on Shabbos, we are not just doing something that we, you know, perhaps enjoy, don't enjoy. This is one of the ways that we are ma'anig Shabbos. And then he says something which is very surprising. If a person does not eat hot food on Shabbos, you have to wonder whether or not this person is in fact a min, you know, whether he's involved in some form of heresy. Why would we call a person who doesn't eat on Shabbos a heretic? That's a bit extreme. So probably this is an allusion to the fact that the Torah does say in Parshas Vayakel, lo sevaru eish b'chom ha-shvaseichem yom ha-shabbos. The Torah says that you should not light fires in all of your dwellings on Shabbos. And we know that the Tzedukim, who only studied the Torah Shabbat, but did not accept the Torah Shabbat Pes, so they understood not just that you cannot light, ignite a fire on Shabbos, they understood that you can't have fires burning on Shabbos. So they sat in the dark, they ate in the dark, which, according to some, is one of the reasons why Chazal Institute, that we dafka have to light candles on Shabbos. We go out of our way to have an Eish on Shabbos. Of course, we light it beforehand, but we do so not exclusively, but perhaps at least partially, as a demonstration that, no, we, in fact, believe that we should have fires burning on Shabbos. Not just that there should be light in the room, but the food should be hot. Now, people like cold food. That's okay. You can have cold food as well. But we're not going to say that if a person is a real chassid, a person wants to be accept all the chumras in the world, so I'm going to avoid all the shilas that could possibly come up when it comes to Bishul Shabbos, and I'm going to eat everything cold. So the answer is, well, you have to deal with the Baal HaMor, who says that no, the way to be ma'anig Shabbos properly is to serve and to eat, partake of at least some hot food. So there's no easy way out, which again, I imagine you know, because you're all here. Now, here's a nice picture of the Lama Tes Melachos. We're not going to go all through these right now, but this is a very nice picture guide to the 39 Melachos. We know that the Mishnah, Masechet Shabbos, in the 7th Parak teaches that there are 39 categories of labor that are forbidden on Shabbos. Generally speaking, probably labor actually is not the best translation of the word Melacha, because labor implies, anyhow, that somebody is doing something which involves a very significant exertion of energy. The fact of the matter is that Melacha can sometimes involve something that doesn't require much effort at all, but it is defined generally as being a positive, constructive activity, one in which a person essentially is acting in a creative fashion, a creative manner, which really goes to the core of what Shabbos is all about. When the Torah tells us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world in 6 days, and then on the seventh day he rested, our refraining from Melacha on Shabbos is a way of demonstrating that we sort of emulate on some level during the 6 days, the 6 work days, we also try to create. Of course, we cannot create on the level of the Creator with a capital C, but we are also acting in a way in which demonstrates our ability to use our minds and our experience and to manipulate the world around us and nature in a way that demonstrates creativity. So the 39 Melachos on Shabbos are the 39 categories in which we could, you know, potentially violate Shabbos. Now, the first, there's a whole list, again, of 39, as you just saw. The first 11 of them are known as what's called the Sidur de Pas, which is literally the order of preparing bread. So the first one, as listed in the Mishnah, is Hazareya, planting. The second one is plowing, even though the Gemara points out that plowing really comes before planting. But otherwise, they generally go in order over here. Harvesting and gathering and threshing and winnowing and selecting and grinding and sifting and kneading. A lush is kneading with a K, of course. And then it says over here, Mevashel, but it's in our Mishnah, it's Lish is Ofer, but it's really, as we're going to see in a moment, one of the same. And we're really going to be focusing on that last one. Of course, when we talk about practical applications of Hilchos Shabbos, we can definitely talk about real life, everyday situations that come up, which would involve any one of those first 10 melachos over here. But we are really focusing, as the title of this series is Bishul Shabbos, on the last one on this list when it comes to Bishul Shabbos. Now, it is important to note that when we speak about melacha, we're talking about a very specific, it's a very specific designation of something which is also on Shabbos. I don't know if you mentioned, if you remember that earlier the Mishnah Berurah referred to something called a shvus. A shvus is a word that we use to describe something which is asur on Shabbos, but it is only asur midirabbanan. There are times that the rabbis have forbidden us from doing certain things because it may lead to the violation of a malach on Shabbos. Of course, there are many other terms that we use to describe things that can and cannot be done on Shabbos. One of the most common examples is muksa. Sometimes you find children, very, very young ages, they'll use the word muksa to describe anything that they can't do. It's all muksa, which is, again, for a 2 or 3 year old, that's great. I mean, there's no problem over there. You don't have to correct a 2 or 3 year old to say, no, it's not muksa. Because in their mind, if you can't touch something, you can't moon something, Shabbos, they put it all together. But, you know, for the purpose, we're going to try to be as precise in our formulation and our description of what's going on over here. While it's true that Bishul B'Shabbos is one of the 39 melachos, but most of the situations that we would potentially encounter that we're going to discuss in the kitchen don't actually involve real Bishul B'Shabbos for several reasons, actually, that we will get to tonight. Okay. Now, when it comes to cooking or baking, so the Rambam in Hilchos Shabbos teaches Ha'ofek gogeres chayev echad ha'ofes ha'pasa mevashel ha'samaychel o ha'melchamim ha'samayim ha'kol inyan echad hu. There are many ways that we can take fire or heat and transform food in some manner. Baking, cooking, frying, roasting, grilling, which I guess is roasting, and probably others as well. For the purpose of our discussion, it's all the same. The halacha does not differentiate between cooking or baking and cooking, and one should never be confused. Well, since Sidur de Pas, by definition, means the preparation of bread, so therefore, since you bake bread, you don't cook bread, so therefore, one is worse than the other. We don't say that. We say whenever you take, and we're going to try to be a little more specific in a moment, but whenever either fire or some other form of heat which has been generated, with one exception we'll get to in a moment, so if it's applied to food in a manner which transforms the food, either making it edible or much better than it was beforehand, so that is going to be considered, that's going to be considered a violation of the Melacha or Bishul B'Shabbos. Interestingly, Rama goes on to teach us that it's not even limited to food. In theory, it could be applied to other situations as well. Now, this over here, you see a candle that is melting. But if a person had wax that accumulates, let's say, and wants to clean it up, and would take hot water in order to pour it over that wax to melt it and then to clean it up, this could potentially be an issur d'oraisa of cooking on Shabbos. Now, you're not going to eat the wax. So we shouldn't think that Bishul only applies in situations where I'm going to eat that which it is I am cooking. And other potential situations, if I take, let's say, foil and put it directly on top of a fire, probably you would only do that if there was food inside of there, which will be a separate problem. But even if you just took foil, let's say, metal, something else, and put it on the fire, so the Rambam teaches, klalo shadavar, bein sreifa guf kasha be'esh, or shahuk shabe'esh, harezem chayim v'shem vashel, doesn't make a difference whether what you're doing gets harder or gets softer, it doesn't make a difference. The Rambam I went too far. Says over here, it absolutely doesn't apply only to food. It can apply to metals and other materials as well. So just know that while we're going to be basically talking about food when it comes to Bishop Shabbos, technically, as far as the melacha is concerned, it is not limited in that regard. What is the definition of bishul in halachic terms? So this is probably the best definition that we're going to work. The change or transformation of the properties of a food or a substance through the application of a heat source. You don't have to memorize that. It's a mouthful. But as you're going to see, because we're going to be a little more specific now in a moment, if you remove any one of these factors, so it's no longer going to meet the halachic definition of bishul. So if there is no real change or transformation that is taking place, it is not considered bishul. Actually, interesting shiloh, which I hope doesn't come up often, but imagine a person forgets a Shabbos and takes food and puts it in the oven. Let's say the oven's on. And realizes a minute or two later, wait a minute, it's a Shabbos. Takes it right out of the oven. So has that person violated an Isser of bishul? So what would you say?
There was no change.
I'll challenge you a little bit. We're not going to discuss this right now, but just to confuse a little bit. So if you said there was no change and the answer is not bishul, you're right. But interestingly, if a person puts a seed in the ground on Shabbos and then realizes afterwards and then remove it, that is considered a malacha, even though obviously it didn't take root, the seed did not disintegrate or anything like that. So that concept doesn't necessarily apply universally when it comes to all malachos. When it comes to bishul, however, there has to actually be a change or transformation of the properties of the food or substance through the application of a heat source. Now, what does that mean through the application of a heat source? So that's the first topic we're going to talk about, source of heat. The Mishnah and the Gemara in Masechet Shabbos talk about bishul v'chama, cooking in the sun. Anybody here ever cook in the sun? Obviously not on Shabbos, or maybe you do on Shabbos. Anybody? No? Okay. Camping. Okay, good. I don't think I've ever cooked in the sun. So cooking in the sun, believe it or not, the Gemara teaches, b'chama d'kuliyama lo pligi d'shari. There's actually no machlokas whatsoever. There's a consensus among the rabbis that cooking directly in the sun on Shabbos is permissible. Now, before you get all excited and say, that's it, we're going to have a big barbecue in the sun, how that's actually applied is not so simple, especially because, as we're going to see in a moment, there's something called toldas hachama, something which derives its heat from the sun. So it's not so simple that this works. But in theory, if a person, I think this is actually a picture of an egg that was placed on top of a car. I don't think I would eat it anyway, but you're just baking it directly in the sun. So this is permissible. Then the Gemara goes on to say, betoldas ha'or kuliyama pligi d'asur. Something which is a derivative of fire, everybody would say is asur. Now over here you have a picture of a person who's preparing eggs in a frying pan. Now when you think about it, the eggs are not coming in direct contact with the fire. So maybe you would think, since it's not touching the fire, so therefore this is not real bishul. So the Gemara says, no, that's called toldas ha'or. This is a derivative. It's deriving its heat from the fire. And so therefore, everybody is going to agree that this is something which is prohibited. Ki pligi, the homachlokes, is what's called toldas hachama. When it comes to, let's say, a frying pan that was heated up in the sun. So then you'll have a machlokes as to whether or not that's considered to be an issur d'rabbanan or not. It's definitely not an issur d'oraisa. And basically, for our purposes in Shulchan Aruch, we learn that it is prohibited for a person to cook, to bake, again, anything in the fire, or in a derivative of the fire. Now, an interesting question to just explore, and you'll see in a moment with some practical consequences, why is bishul b'chama mutter? Why is it permissible to cook in the sun? Now, that's a funny question to ask, because, you know, there are really two ways of looking at the world through the prism of halacha. One way of looking at it is that everything in the world is usur, until proven otherwise. Another way of looking at the world is everything in the world is mutter until you're told otherwise. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but it's a good question to ask yourself sometimes. Like, how do you look at the world? Is everything in the world forbidden unless somebody's told me otherwise? So I personally think the more healthy perspective of life in general, and I think for the most part it's true, is that everything in the world is mutter. Everything's mutter. You're allowed to do whatever you want. It happens to be that there are a few areas where, no, you can't do this, you can't touch this, you can't eat this. That's true. So maybe you think it's not really a fair question, but given the fact that we saw that cooking is considered to be, obviously, this is one of the Abbas Malachos, because it is considered to be a creative act. So why is Bishul B'chama Mutter? A person, after all, it takes some some act on the part of the individual who's got to crack the egg, and he puts it in a certain position at a certain time. So why is it mutter? So you basically have two approaches that are found in the poskim. Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zechonu Livracha, and the Truvis explains, because this is not, he says it's shelo kederech bishul. It's not the normal manner of bishul, and it's considered almost sort of a shinoi of sorts. This is almost an unusual way of doing the melacha. Now, this is a good time to remind ourselves that when it comes to melacha on Shabbos, there is a concept of shinoi. This doesn't always work in all areas of melacha. If you don't like somebody at work, you can't kill them with a shinoi. It doesn't work that way. It's still an issur of murder with a shinoi. And the same is true when it comes to virtually all issurim in the Torah. But when it comes to Hilcha Shabbos, Melacha on Shabbos, there's a concept of shinoi. Why is there a concept of shinoi? What does that mean when something is done shelo kederech, shelo kedarko? So the idea, going back to our definition of melacha, given that melacha is something which is supposed to be, again, positive, constructive human activity, so the idea that we do something in the normal, typical fashion, so as long as we are doing it the way it's normally done, so it falls within the mezgeret of melacha. Once we do something in a very unusual way, so it's no longer considered, it no longer fits the parameters of what melacha is. Which is why, as you know, there are situations where if a person must violate Shabbos, which we're really not talking about for the most part in this entire series, but if a person must violate Shabbos, so then all things being equal, it is better to do it with a shinoi, because at least this way you minimize, mitigate, and maybe downgrade the extent of the issur. So Moshe basically says Bishul Chama is not the normal way that people cook. That makes sense. Another explanation from Shlomo Zalman Orbach is that Bishul Chama is not Bishul. It's not considered bishul at all. Meaning that we don't assume that just because you put food in a place where it gets hot, and again, the properties of the food changes, and now it's, let's say, before it was inedible, now it's edible, so that's bishul. Says Rav Shlomo Zalman, no. That bishul has a certain definition, and bishul means that it has to either be with fire, or what we said, told us or. Are there any practical difference between these two answers? So the answer is yes. I'll suggest two. One would be, let's say, solar heating, which is very common in Israel. Maybe it's becoming more common here, but I don't think it's ever going to be so common. But, you know, there you have a picture. I don't know if this is actually from Israel. The picture of, you know, you've seen those, the Dud Shemesh on the roof, where the water is heated in the sun. Now, in all fairness, I'm not even sure that that's necessarily solar heating in the most technical halachic sense. But let's assume, for the purpose of discussion at the moment, it is. What would we say about solar water that was heated in the sun, using some sort of solar panel like this. So according to Rav Moshe, you can argue that this would actually be usur, because this is the normal way that, you know, that this water is cooked. This is the normal fashion. It's prepared precisely for this reason, whereas Rav Shlomo Zalman perhaps would argue, no, that's not bishul. Bishul, by definition, has to be with fire, not in the sun. Another possibility was, let's say, when it comes to microwave cooking, something that was cooked in a microwave on Shabbos, is that considered? Now, practically, you're going to have a hurdle that's going to be difficult to overcome over here, and that is even turning the microwave on is going to be usur for other reasons. But it's not a completely hypothetical question to ask. It may be relevant when it comes to something that was like cooked beforehand, let's say in a microwave. And when we're talking about Eidu Bishol, Acha Bishol, so is something that was cooked in a microwave considered to be cooked or not? Or is cooking on a microwave in Shabbos considered cooking? Or going back to the question I gave before, if you're dealing with, let's say, a situation where a person must have cooked food, let's say, chola, and there's some justification for it, so would we say that microwave cooking is better than cooking on the fire? So, again, according to Rav Moshe, no, this is the derech, this is the normal way to do it. According to Shlomo Zalman, presumably would say that's not derech Bishol. I'm sorry, it's not derech, it's not bishul. You know, bishul, ba'or, which means in the fire, batolos or means through application of heat. Microwave cooking doesn't involve the application of heat. Okay, now when we talk about toldos ha'esh, which you remember the Gemara says prohibited, this includes any source of heat, whether something is near the fire, a hot surface, a radiator. These are situations where, and this is not this is not supposed to be an exclusive list. Anything that you could think to add to this list, in which you have some either actual fire or an electric appliance or something in which heat is generated, this could potentially be a situation in which we could run into bishul problems. Most people don't actually cook food on radiators. but you could, in theory, warm it. Remember, the Poskim talking Shmir Shabbos talks about if a person comes in from the outside and has, let's say, their coat gets all wet, and you put it down on top of the radiator, you could potentially have a situation over there, even though it's not your kavan over there, to cook the water that's accumulated in your coat and the sweater. But there are, in theory, situations that can come up like this. But the idea is that it doesn't make a difference whether it's an actual fire where you see it, what's electric and not electric. Whenever there is a source that is producing heat, so then we assume that is an area which, you know, again, potentially you could be dealing with a bishul problem. Another form of toldos ha'esh is what's called a kli rishon. Now, before we talk a little bit about what a kli rishon means, I want to say that next week we're going to spend probably the entire time, if not the bulk of the time, talking about kalim. When I mean kalim, I mean like the whole idea of kli rishon, kli sheni, kli shlishi, obviously common questions about preparing coffee and tea, etc. We're really not going to get into that tonight, but just conceptually, as we present this, we're starting with, okay, there's fire, and then, of course, there's ovens, and there are stovetops, and then there are hot plates, and there are, you know, radiators. And another area where you can have something called toldos ha'esh would be a kli rishon. A kli rishon means, kli implies that it's some sort of vessel. So it could be a cup, it could be a pot, it could be a bowl. Doesn't really make a difference. And the contents of that kli, which usually is liquid, has reached a certain temperature, which we're going to define in a moment. So now you're dealing with potentially a shiloh bishul. So that would mean that if you had, let's say, I'll be more descriptive in a moment. If you had a pot of hot water on the fire and you stuck something that wasn't cooked into that water, so then that would be a form of cooking it. That's called a kli rishon. So there are different types of kli rishon. One is called a kli rishon al gabi ha'esh. Gabi ha'esh means that the kli rishon is still on top of the fire. So here are two examples, common examples. One is a kettle, and again, it could apply to a pot of chicken soup also. And the other one is an urn that is plugged in. If the urn is not plugged in, then it's not al gabi ha'esh. But the point I want you to realize, of course, is that just because an urn is not literally sitting on top of the stovetop, it is, for all intents and purposes, considered to be a kli rishon al gabi ha'esh because the heat is coming out. So as long as it is generating heat and making the contents of the urn hot, so for our purpose that's called the kli rishon al gabi ha'esh. The reason it's important to know this terminology is we're going to start to talk specific cases about, may you put something in a kli rishon al gabi ha'esh? What's the answer to that question, by the way? The answer is no. Never. But, however, there's something else called the kli rishon shelo al gabi ha'esh. That would be an example of a, let's say, the kettle that has been removed from the fire. So why is it a kli rishon? It's a kli rishon because it was once on the fire, and let's say the water is still a certain temperature, again, which we'll define in a moment. Can you put something in a kli rishon shelo al gabi ha'esh? The answer is sometimes. So there is a difference between a kli rishon that is on the fire and a kli rishon that is off the fire. Then there's something else called a kli sheni. A kli sheni, I think most of us are familiar with this idea, is when you take the contents, let's say from the urn, from the kettle, and pour it into another vessel, let's say a cup or a mug. So then there's a halacha. It's not it's not like a kula, which is found in the latter-day poskim. This is straight out of the Gemara, that a kli sheni is not mevashel. A kli sheni is not mevashel, which means if you pour or you put something that was not cooked into a kli sheni, it cannot cook it. Or maybe say it a little differently, it's not considered to be an act of bishul. Now, why is that? That's a little strange, wouldn't you think? What sort of question comes to your mind when you hear a kli rishon is mevashel, but a kli sheni is not mevashel? It's a little strange.
It's still applying heat, it still would change the properties.
Right, so you would think that we wouldn't really care whether it's a kli rishon or a kli sheni, we should just look at what?
The temperature.
So Tosfos asked that question. So first of all, you should know that there are exceptions to this rule, so just to know. So Tosfos in Shabbos Daf Mem Amud Beis says, Teima, ma'ishna kli sheni mekli rishon, what's the difference? The iyad soledes, which we haven't really introduced yet, but we're going to see in a moment, if it's, let's say, 120 degrees, I'm making up a number, if it's a certain temperature, afilu kli sheni nami. So even if it's in the second kli, it should be a problem. The iyad soledes, and if it's not yet has reached that threshold, that temperature, so afilu kli rishon nami ainu mevashel. So then even a kli rishon should not be mevashel. Why should it make a difference whether it's the first kli or the second kli? And then Tosfos gives the following answer. Rishon Kli Rishon, because at one point it was on the fire, by definition, that's what a Kli Rishon means. It is either on the fire now or at one point it was. Therefore, the walls of this Kli have been heated up, and therefore it retains the heat longer. And therefore, it is considered to be an act of Bishul to put something in. Even the contents are still hot. Mutter, in some cases, you're permitted to put something in. Because the walls are not hot, and therefore it will cool it down more. Which is, we see this, because you know when the water comes out of the urn, it's very hot, and then you pour it into a mug, and it, you know, it starts to get a little cooler, and if you pour it into another one, this is actually true. I remember hearing once that Rav Soloveitchik pointed out that there may be a problem in some of the hotels. Maybe people do this at home, but I don't think it's so common. But in the hotels, when they were serving soup to many, many hundreds of people, so in order to keep the soup warm, they would warm up the bowls beforehand. Maybe they would put them in the oven so they'd be warm, and this way when they put the soup in the bowls and serve them, the soup would be hot. So you see where the problem is already. Can we say that that soup bowl is a Kli Sheni? Maybe not. Because the whole svar, according to Tosfos, as to why Kli Sheni is not mevashel, it's because the walls aren't hot. Well, if you heat up the walls beforehand, maybe it is. But this is not the only explanation that we find as to why Kli Sheni is not mevashel. One is resource Tosfos. Yerushalmi has a different explanation. And that is that even a Kli Rishon on a Torah level cannot be considered a form of Bishul. That once something has been removed from the fire, it's not considered to be Bishul. And so therefore, Chazal said, they made a gezeira that when it comes to the Kli Rishon, it's a problem, but Kli Sheni is not a problem. Another explanation is that it's not considered derech bishul, it's not the normal manner of cooking. So the different explanations as to why Kli Sheni is not mevashel. I think it's important to just have this conversation because I'm sure from time to time, you know, you stop and you say, what doesn't make any sense. You know, the water is coming out, steaming hot out of the urn, and I can't stick the, let's say, coffee. I can't make coffee yet. But I put it into the Kli Sheni, so then I can. But really, the water is the same temperature as far as I can tell. So what's the difference? So here are three possible explanations as to why that changes. But the fact of the matter is, as we saw, a Kli Rishon, you cannot cook a Kli Sheni, you can. This is not a practical discussion. That's going to wait until next week. But this is just sort of introducing the concept of Kli Rishon, Kli Sheni, so we can have, again, a more intelligent conversation next week. The next topic for discussion is shear bishul, which means what is the threshold? How do we measure whether or not something is considered cooked or not? If you go to a restaurant where they serve a steak, I mean, it's only, not only at a restaurant, but often they'll ask you, how do you like your steak? You know, rare, medium rare, well done, medium well done, right? There are probably many other dargas in between. So we know that there are many different levels of cooking something. So in halachic terms, when is something considered cooked? So the Gemara introduces a shear known as Maichel Ben Jusoi, which means literally the food that was eaten by someone Ben Jusoi. Rashi says of Ben Jusoi was a famous, he was a thief, and he was some sort of bandit who was always on the run. And since he was always running away from the police, so therefore he would have to prepare his food and eat it very quickly because they would you know catch up with him. They would find his trail. So therefore, he would not sit down for long periods of time and prepare a very, very well-done steak. He would cook it just enough. What's just enough? So Rashi says over there, shlish. Umivasha bishulo shlish, says Rashi. One-third cooked is already considered to be, in halachic terms, that's cooked enough. That doesn't mean you like it that way. But that's considered to be how cooked is considered to be an act of bishul. The Rambam actually defines it a little differently as being chatzi bishul, that has to cook halfway of what is considered to be norm. But the important point that we need to realize is that when we're speaking about cooking on Shabbos, we're not speaking in the most absolute terms that you take something that was completely raw and now it is completely cooked. There are it's a spectrum of sorts, and there are certain points we can actually start a little later, which actually brings me to the next point, and that is that even if something is fully cooked, what's called mevushal kol tzorcho, it may still be subject to bishul if by keeping it in the fire, in the oven, whatever it is, longer, makes it taste better. So this is something we're going to discuss later, but even if something is way beyond half or third cooked, it's basically fully cooked, if continuing to cook it will make it taste better, it may be still be subject to the laws of Bishul. And furthermore, I don't believe that this has any practical significance that I can think of, but there is a machlokas Rishonim. If there's Bishul ben Atar, when you go from Maichel ben Jusoy to Kol Tzarcho, let's say you take something that's a third or a half cooked, and then you cook it to its full state, whether that's considered to be an actual Issa d'Oraisa, it's either way, it's going to be also to do that, so really not very practical. Now that's when it comes to solids. When it comes to liquids, we have a completely different definition, and a term that I already mentioned, that it may be familiar to some. By liquids, we refer to something called Yad Soled Esbo. Yad Soled Esbo literally means, anybody want to translate those words? Yad Soled Esbo? When you withdraw your hand. Very good. I'm glad you said that, as opposed to something called Yad Nichve Esbo, when your hand is burned. Yad Soled Esbo is not as hot as some people may think, because when we, you know, if a person sticks their hand under boiling water, so even if it's just there for a second or two, they may really get hurt. Yad Soled Esbo, there are people who perhaps even shower or take baths in water that is Yad Soled Esbo. Yad Soled Esbo is a temperature where if you didn't know that the water was hot and you would stick it in, you would just immediately withdraw your hand because you would think maybe it's hot. So sometimes that happens. You touch it and then, oh, that wasn't so bad. And you touch again, you see it's not so hot. The Gemara actually tells us it's the sheer shekreso sheltinog nichves, if a baby's stomach abdomen is a little more sensitive to the skin, so it could actually be burned. Obviously, this is not something you experiment with at home, goes without saying. But the point is that this is how the Gemara describes the temperature of Yad Soled Esbo. Thankfully, we have our poskim to give us a little more specifically, so we don't have to actually burn anybody in the process. This is only going to help us so far, because first of all, most of us, I can only speak for myself, if you would ask me to stick my finger in water and tell you, you know, what's the temperature, I would have absolutely no way of knowing. Maybe there are certain people who have practice and their sensitivity level is such that they can actually tell you. But this is really not so helpful because it is, as you're going to see, there's somewhat of a range over here. Rav Moshe Feinstein said that Yad Soled Esbo, it's not clear exactly what it is. It could be anywhere from 110 to 160 degrees Fahrenheit, which again is quite a range. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach says it's not, excuse me for the type over there, not less than 113 degrees. Avraham Cutler Zichrono Livracha, not less than 120 degrees. So the idea is that we don't have an absolute consensus over here as to what precisely the temperature is. But for the most part, it's not going to matter. And the reason I say that is because we're not really taking water and heating it up on Shabbos and stopping right before we get Yad Soled Esbo. I mean, maybe if you forget and you put something closer than it should be, we're really trying to determine as to, you know, how and what circumstances we can, you know, put something into certain things. And so this is an important shear, but Lemaisa, as we're going to see, it doesn't really matter so much whether it's 110, 113, 120 for practical guidance in the kitchen. Just for purpose of comparison, just to know, a lukewarm bath is 100 degrees, a hot bath is under 4 degrees, a hot cup of coffee is typically served 125, tea 165, and steaming hot chicken soup is 180 degrees. So, give you a little sense as to Yad Soled Esbo. Again, we saw that it may be anywhere from 110 to 160, but if a hot bath is 104 degrees, so I guess I was wrong. I guess most people wouldn't take a bath in 110 degrees, apparently. But it's by our standards, it's really not that hot if you think about the fact that, you know, people will drink a cup of coffee at 125 degrees. Okay, the last concept we're going to discuss for tonight as part of sort of this introduction discussion is the question of Ein Bishul Achar Bishul. So what's going on over here? So the Mishnah in Shabbos Daf Kuf Mem Hei Beis teaches that once something has been cooked, so there is no issur to recook it on Shabbos. So the term Ein Bishul Achar Bishul is a little confusing for some, how you translate those words. Ein Bishul Achar Bishul, sometimes Ein means you can't do something. But over here, it actually doesn't mean that. It means Ein Bishul Achar Bishul, meaning once something has been cooked, you can't cook it again because it's been cooked. You can only cook something once. So there is no cooking something once it's been cooked. That comes from the Mishnah. If anything, this opens possibility of great leniency. In fact, I would say that, in fact, this principle is the principle which does make Shabbos as manageable as it is, because if anybody here ever reheats food that was cooked before Shabbos, how do you do that? Again, there are many other questions that need to be dealt with, but fundamentally we do that because it's been cooked already. And once you cook it, you can't recook it. Now, there are three important conditions. Number one, this only applies by solids and not liquids, at least according to the Ramah. This is the Machlokas of Shulchan Aruch, but we paskin like the Ramah generally that even though when it comes to solids, ain't bishal chabishul, yesh bishal chabishul when it comes to liquids. So that would mean that if you had water that, let's say, was heated up before Shabbos and then it cooled down, if you would heat it up again, then that would be considered a new act of bishul. And at least when we're dealing with water, that sort of makes sense because even though, you know, it could be on some, there may be benefits to boiling water, even if you're going to cook it down afterwards, it may, you know, maybe kill some of the germs, bacteria, etc. But still, as far as we can tell, you know, once water is cooked and then cools down, it tastes the same. There's no permanent change as far as the taste is concerned, as opposed to, let's say, chicken or fish. It doesn't make a difference what it is. Once the solid has been cooked, it doesn't, and it cools down, it's still cooked. So that's the first important condition. Number two, the method of reheating must be the same as the original, which we'll get to in a moment. So just because something was cooked beforehand doesn't mean it's not potentially subject to baking afterwards. In fact, I think that's how they make bagels, isn't it? Bagels are boiled and then they're baked. So that, you know, again, that just because they do it by bagels doesn't mean that it's so la halacha. But in other words, you can take something that's been cooked, or in that case boiled, and then bake it, and there's something else that happens to it. And the third condition over here is that the method of reheating must be proper. So, of course, we're going to stop in a couple of minutes. I don't want anybody walking out of here thinking that you can take anything that's cooked and you can put it in the oven, you can put it right on the stove. There are going to be other issues they're going to run into, mostly the Rabbanan issues. Actually, I would say exclusively, if it's been cooked already, you can potentially run into a problem of violating an Issa D'Oraisa on Shabbos if whatever you're cooking has been cooked already beforehand. If it's a solid, it really cannot conceivably be a problem of bishul once it's been cooked beforehand. But that doesn't mean, practically speaking, you could just take anything that's been cooked beforehand and do whatever you want with it. So an example of taking something that's been fully cooked beforehand and putting it in a situation which it would otherwise be subject to cooking would be like taking cold boiled chicken and placing it in a kli rishon that's been removed from the fire. Or taking matzah balls and placing them in a pot of chicken soup that has been removed from the fire. Again, removed from the fire, going back to what we said beforehand, the concept of kli rishon shaloa gabi eish. But these are examples where I am taking something and putting it into something which is considered to be toldos ha'or. This is something which would normally be subject to bishul, but in this case, since it's been cooked beforehand, it's not going to be a problem. Now, since I said this applies to solids and not liquids, so how do we define solids or dry as opposed to something which is lach? In halachic terms, we speak of yavesh and lach. So yavesh doesn't have to be completely dry. Just as long as there's no significant accumulation of liquid, it's considered to be yavesh. I don't know if that's a great picture, but if you can tell, there's a picture of a chicken over there. Obviously, it looks fully cooked, and there's some liquid on the bottom, maybe a little juices that came out of the chicken, the schmaltz. And the truth of the matter is, I don't even like that picture so much because we could be a little more generous, perhaps, with what is on the bottom of the pot, and that would still be considered in halacha a davar lach. It doesn't have to be completely... I'm sorry, thank you. It doesn't have to be completely dehydrated, dry. I mean, that we don't call it dehydrated, do we? Whatever. On the other hand, you want to be careful if you're reheating frozen food, which may have like ice or frost on it. You wouldn't want to put it anywhere it could reach Yad Soledesbo. So I don't know if that's a very common situation, but you just want to think about the idea that if there is something which has a significant accumulation of liquid, or in this case ice or frost, you wouldn't want to cook that up. When defining lach, so any liquid or soupy food, not moisture on the food, that we already said that's not, so that would be considered to be a davar lach. There was a kula that was cited by some poskim. Ravad Yosef has this in a tshuva. I think I saw somewhere that maybe the Rav said this as well, but for the most part, I don't think that this is typically relied upon, that anything that you eat with a fork is by definition, that's considered to be davar yavesh. No. It used to be a commercial for Campbell's soup, right? Soup that you...
So chunky.
Eat with your fork. So it's hard to say that Campbell's soup would be considered a davar yavesh. But I don't know, according to some poskim, maybe it is. But generally you say is that davar lach is something which is liquid or soupy food. The Ramah is machmir, if the liquid was netzan in the gam, we're going to discuss this more later, but the idea is that once a liquid has been cooled down entirely, so then it's potentially subject to the yisur of reheating it. I don't know why that happened. Okay, and finally, even though we said in bishul achar bishul, it's a question when it comes to, let's say, bishul achar afia. This is not the only sort of combination of different types of cooking that we could discuss, but this is the most common one. When something has been baked, is it then potentially subject to the iser of bishul? So here you have a machlokas rishonim. If you have something that was baked beforehand, and then you put it in a place where it could get cooked, is that a problem? Maybe we'd say the new process is sort of mevatel, it sort of overrides or undoes the original one. So here you have machlokas between Rav Elazar Mitz and Rav Yah, whether this is in fact considered to be a problem. Their machlokas, they were talking about matzah mevushelis, matzah brai. You know, the most common scenario where this comes up, I think, is when people talk about, let's say, dipping challah in the soup. May not be an issue anyhow, if you're talking about a klisheni, and generally soup and the soup bowls are a klisheni, but I'm going to say may or may not for the time being. We're going to come back to that. There you go. You can't put something baked into a kli rishon for sure, or a klisheni maybe, because it depends what it is. Also, a question regarding something that was fried, such as croutons, if that's considered bishul or not. Some poskim say that deep fried is for sure bishul, so there would be reason to be makel, let's say, by osem croutons. That's not to the exclusion of any others, but osem croutons happen to be deep fried. It's probably good to know that anyway. And since they are deep fried, that is considered to be bishul, so would not at all be subject to this this problem. Okay, so I think we are done for tonight. So just to, I'm not going to review everything, but basically to review how we started, and that is that the purpose of tonight's presentation was really just to provide a basic overview of some of the most important rules and concepts and sort of kollel that we're going to discuss. And starting already next week, we're going to start to get into more of the particulars. And I think next week we'll probably spend most of the time talking about kli rishon, kli sheni, kli shishi, what that means, and how it applies to some very practical common scenarios that we will face in the kitchen. Thank you very much. Have a great week.